People routinely view biblical events with skepticism until proven otherwise. And then, and even then I should add, skepticism often lingers. Jericho actually fits in this category. Between 1907 and 1911, German archaeologists Ernest Sellen and Carl Watzinger completed one of the first scientific excavations of Jericho to determine if the location where they had chosen was indeed Jericho and that the walls, as they fell down, had matched the biblical account. While their excavation methods were a bit outdated by today's standards, Sellen and Watzinger indeed found Jericho's walls. Further, they determined that the walls had fallen in exactly the way that Scripture offers. Sellen and Watzinger's dating of the fall differed some from the biblical account, but their findings indeed supported exactly what we read in Scripture. Move forward 20 years and you wind up 1930 to 1936. British archaeologist John Garsting completed the next series of excavations in the area of Jericho. Garsting found not only what Sellen and Watzinger found, but much more. Using more modern methods of excavation, Garsting discovered collapsed walls, evidence of intense burning, and pots full of burned grain. He interpreted the signs as indeed verifying of God's word. Indeed, even as he went through and did all his studies, he went back to the biblical account and found that it was indeed accurate. We move forward one more time 15 years to 1952 to 1958. British archaeologist Kathleen Kenyon next set her sights on Jericho. Using, at that time, groundbreaking archaeological tools, even as you make sense of what she did, Kenyon agreed the city's famous walls had been destroyed. But she argued that the timing was different than the biblical record. Although Kenyon never saw a time when her findings were refuted, scholars since have been all over the map in terms of timing, but they haven't disagreed in terms of what they found at the location of Jericho. While her research has been incredibly advanced, they acknowledge that her work oftentimes only focused on a very short section of the city, about 26 square feet, and at the same time, they recognize as well that the walls she looked at, despite the advances in archaeology, were only one section of multiple walls at the time, and we'll get there momentarily. Since Kenyon's work, multiple archaeologists have then found Jericho, and they've gone back to make sense of its ruins. It makes sense that they would, because Jericho is kind of a target-rich environment for published findings. And even as they go back, whether the archaeologist believes in what's there or not, they have indeed reinforced what we know to be true to that region. For those of you who know God's truth and understand the story that's here, and I think the whole room knows this story, so it's difficult to maybe add something more, we're going to go back to that remarkable story today, even as Mr. Graby touched on it last, the first day of Unleavened Bread. And we went in there. And given the storyline and the fact that the last day of Unleavened Bread would coincide exactly with the day in which Jericho fell, it makes sense for us to go right back into that section and, pun intended, dig a little bit deeper on this. So that's my aim today, because what I aim for us to do is not only go through that section, but also, and I'll use this term purposely, unearth a few lessons of value even as we leave these last days of Unleavened Bread. I've entitled this message then, Israel's Miraculous Victory at Jericho. Israel's Miraculous Victory at Jericho. Let's deal with some background to the story, because it's helpful, and you may be flipping in your Bible to Joshua, that's where the story is found, Joshua 1. If we make some sense of what precedes Joshua 1, it's helpful at least to get our minds wrapped around the events that take place immediately before Joshua 1. Even as we head for the book of Joshua, we should be reminded of what takes place right in the preceding chapters if you make sense of Deuteronomy 33, 34, thereabouts. To offer just a synopsis of what's there, because of the hardness of their hearts, we well remember that Israel had wandered for 40 years in the wilderness. They had been at the Promised Land, they had been at Canaan, but they were not allowed to go in. After 120 years, we happen to have recalled, you may recall, that Moses had died on Mount Nebo. He was given opportunity to go right up to the Promised Land to look in, but not to enter it because of an action on his part. We also know that Moses was instructed to transfer leadership to an individual by the name of Joshua. Now, we've known of Joshua for some time in scriptures. I guess for those of us who happen to be pretty movie savvy, the Ten Commandments was on this last Sunday. You can't miss Joshua in that movie and the role he played, even as we see Moses play out so much of what we see as the leader of Israel. But if we go back, it's helpful to be reminded that Joshua had also been a Hebrew slave in Egypt. As a devoted assistant of Moses for quite some time, he had seen the people firsthand. He had seen the Israelites certainly stumble for 40 years and grumble for a good part of 40 years. And in doing so, he'd seen and experienced the frustration at times that Moses had experienced. He also recognized that indeed, based upon his belief in what God offered, that eventually Israel would go in. And we're reminded of that in part, even at the first time the spies went into the land. If you recall, Joshua and Caleb were two of those spies. And after spying out the land, if you remember in Numbers 13, they came back and said, as the people were waiting and Moses had asked or prompted, what was the land like? If you remember, it's a wonderful land. It's an amazing land. It's fertile. It's fertile. It's got food. It's got everything that we would want. And then what did 10 of them say? And we can't go there. That is not our place. It doesn't matter what God could do or might do for us. We can't go in that land. If you remember the account there, who is it that then stands up and says, wait a second, have we forgotten who's with us here? It was Joshua and Caleb who stood up and said that. It was unmistakable, they thought, even though there were individuals of large size and there were walled cities, that they would go in and they would take the land and this would be their land, the land that they had so deeply desired even while they were in Egypt. And so that was this Joshua. Based on belief in God, Joshua's resilience and faithfulness to God over time made him a fitting replacement to Moses. And so even as we head for Joshua 2, we wind up with this account, this story that appears between, by and large, Joshua 2 and Joshua 6. Now, if you do some math, and I did the math, I'm not going to claim to know all the verses in the Bible. In fact, I was curious even when Mr. Beam was mentioning the number of people who memorized the entire Bible. Years ago, when I was a young guy and we would travel between church services, my sister and I would sit in the back. One of the ways that I killed time was reading a Ripley's Believe It or Not, pretty common practice. And there were those many times when I was reading through a Ripley's Believe It or Not, and one of the facts might be that there were these five, six, eight individuals who had actually memorized the entire Bible. So I was curious if Mr. Beam was going to go there. And indeed, however they calculate the number of people who can do this, in this case, we happen to have known that there are only a select few, but certainly there must be a select few who've done this. That said, when we get to the story of Jericho, we wind up with about 110 verses. In fact, I've read this every different way you can think of, and I thought to myself, I'm going to lose everyone in the room if I run all 110 verses on them. So I'm going to find a way to skip through those verses. But what I want to do first off is just to give us an overview of what takes place between Joshua 2 and Joshua 6, because it's an excellent read. If we're breaking down topics, that area by topics, you're going to wind up seeing the following headers maybe in your Bible, and if not, you can list in your notes as follows. Joshua 2 principally is about Rahab. That her story is a connection and links with Jericho, we well know. Joshua 3 and 4 involves Israel crossing the Jordan River. Joshua 5 involves the spring feast, the keeping of the spring feast, which is why we would go here now, and the promised land, entering the promised land, Jericho being the first walled city once they're in the promised land. And then ultimately, Joshua 6, which I would probably term the climax of the story, is actually the fall of Jericho. So we can go through this. I would, even before we kind of get into the reading, I'm going to ask that if you're in your notes, you may have already listed a breakdown of the story, and it's helpful to at least signpost it to make sense of where we're going in advance. In fact, even as Mr. Beam was talking, it's common practice, oftentimes in my classes, as needed, offer a quick way of making sure that we retain information more effectively and we process it well. One of the things that's always helpful to do, and many of us know this, is if you're reading a larger section of material, to go through, to always skim. I don't know if you know this, all the research tells us this. If you go and read, for example, if I'm given something to read, a document of some sort, it's always in my best interest to quickly flip through the entire document to get a feel for what's there, to read the headers all the way through there, and then to go back and start my journey through that content. The same holds true here. Even as we make sense of it, it makes sense to map it. Now I'm going to ask that you map it also maybe in your mind's eye, similarly, to think through the section of the country, section of the world, forgive me, that we're dealing with, even as we deal with the promised land. If you're quickly making sense of where Jericho is, and you may have a map in the back of your Bible, and that's fine, it's helpful at least to get our bearings. And if you are a drawer, or visually it's helpful for you, you're going to wind up with the Sea of Galilee a little bit higher on the page if we're drawing, and you might draw a line all the way down to a larger circle. So I might make something on my page about the size of a dime, which would be the Sea of Galilee. You would draw a line down the page, maybe an inch to an inch and a half. And then at the bottom of the page, you would wind up putting, in this case, the Dead Sea. Now, here's why I would offer some sense of what this is, because visually, this starts to immerse us in the content. And if you are just a hair or a shade above, if it helps, a shade above the Dead Sea, that line actually represents, more jagged-like, represents the Jordan River. They have to cross that Jordan River in order to go over to Jericho. So right above your quarter, if you remember as I gave you size recommendations on your little drawing, they're going to start a little bit to the top right of that quarter, and they're going to move across that line, which would have been the Jordan River, into Jericho. Now, visually, that's helpful, at least in terms of mapping where we're headed. So that said, even as I've already shared here, now we have 110 verses to go through, and I'm not doing that. I'm going to go more like about 30. If you will, start with me in Joshua 2. This section then deals first off with Rahab's faith. Verse 1 reads this way. Now, Joshua the son of Nun sent out two men. We have to help happen by background. We have to make a sense of what's here from Acacia Grove to spy secretly, saying, go view the land, especially Jericho. So they went and came to the house of the harlot Rahab and lodged there. A couple of things that are at least helpful for us to make sense of is this Acacia Grove would have been, if we deal with east to west or across your page, it would have been roughly parallel to Jericho, but it would have been on the right side of the Jordan River. So they had to cross that river, which is what we'll get to momentarily, cross it, make sense of it, and that's where the spies were actually sent. Now, if we're thinking about even as the spies went into the promised land, Canaan, it's really helpful at least to get some sense or at least be reminded of what Jericho entailed. Jericho generally was a tell, and a tell, I got to spell T-E-L because it took me a while for me to wrap my mind around this. It's kind of like a layered cake, if it helps. If we make sense of what it looks like, tells happen to be layers. Now, it's a layered cake today. A tell today is kind of over time what we've wound up with. If we've wound up with Jericho generally being covered by dirt and debris and everything else. But Jericho, if it helps, happened to have been a raised city that the spies could easily see. If we're talking about what did the city then look like, the city was a beautiful city. Some have argued, depending on archaeology, who you read, they've said that this is the oldest city in the world. The oldest continuously inhabited city in the world. Jericho at times, though, if you first went into it, was really impressive. If you remember here, it involved not just one wall, but two walls. And in my mind's eye, I used to think that they were two walls about on the same level. Well, if you have a raised area, which they typically took rock and created a barrier on the very base of the city, then they built a first wall above that, and then there was an area that was initially, we would trust, that would be unfortified, no one would be in it. Homes eventually were built in there, and then there was a second set of walls that were put, whereby inside there again was the primary part of the city. If we're dealing with then some sense of what the city looked like, it was well designed by and large. And in fact, many will offer that it was a very beautiful city. It's known for having palm trees around it and in it. It was known as a city of palms. And unlike maybe many other cities, although they were near the Jordan River, they didn't have to worry about water. They had a natural spring that came up right inside the city. And they had beautiful land all the way around the city for the harvest that they wound up drawing and pulling in inside their walls. If we're making sense then of kind of what the size of these walls were, if it helps, most are in agreement by archaeological standards that there was that barrier of rocks, and then the first wall rose about 15 feet or higher. It oftentimes was punctuated at times with towers that easily could see out. Most of the time, well, if I recall, all the time, there were stairwells. The only way you could get up to those towers would be inside. But it was also the width of the walls that were staggering in terms of how big these walls were. You could drive a chariot or two down them, which is how large they were. And the same would hold true to the inner concentric circle, that the second set of walls was even taller. Those walls were to have been about 25 feet, archaeologists say. And again, incredibly wide. And so what we find here is this tower, this city was almost impregnable. No one thought they could get into this city. And so what we find here, even as we start reading, is these spies show up in the city. How did they get into the city? I don't know. We don't know. But we know that they were inside and they began to kind of scout not only the land around it, as they've entered the promised land, but they've started to scout what's in the city. And however it comes to pass, they wind up at Rahab's house. We see that in verse 1. It is helpful as well to just remind ourselves who Rahab was. And you can go and read in verse 1 that she has an occupation, and that occupation is not minimizing anything here. Rahab, yes, was an innkeeper, and most of the Hebrew shows us this, but innkeepers oftentimes were connected with her occupation, which was harlotry. She was a prostitute, which is quite telling, even as we see God work with her. So it will tell us in Scripture that they oftentimes have two. So these two spies find Rahab. Whether she found them or they found her, we don't know. But what we do know is that the king at the time, whose name we don't know, was well aware that there were spies in the city, because they had them looking for these spies, and they happened to have gone to Rahab's house to find them. And she winds up misleading them, however we want to trust here, and we'll get back to that momentarily. She winds up saying, I'm sure that they've just left. Pick up the story, if you will, in verse 8. So before they lay down, this would be on the roof, she came up to them on the roof and said to the man, I know that the Lord has given you the land, that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted because of you. In some instances, some translations have said, their hearts have melted, and we'll see that language here momentarily. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea. That's 40 years removed, and this is still being passed around. For when you came out of Egypt, and what the two kings of the Ammonites who were on the other side of the Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. That's a message for a different day, but that's a powerful lesson in itself about what those who happen to be there in Jericho knew to be true. Verse 11, and as soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted. Neither did there remain any more courage in anyone because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in heaven, above and on earth beneath. Some translations will actually offer, and I have no idea which one you're reading, it actually says here along the lines of her wording, granted this is probably a literal translation as you're going to get, but many will say, he is your God, he is my God too. She professes right up front with him, with them, that the true God is her God. And so she offers as much even as she moves into this. Now, therefore, I beg you, we keep reading. I'll back up just momentarily to verse 11. And as soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted. I noted that. For he is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. I repeat myself. Now, therefore, I beg you, swear to me by the Lord, since I have shown you kindness, that you also will show kindness to my father's house and give me a true token. And spare my father, my brothers, my sisters, and all they have, and deliver our lives from death. So the men answered her, our lives for yours. If none of you tells this business of yours, and it shall be that when the Lord has given us the land, that we will deal kindly and truly with you. And so as we make our way down to verse 15, we'll stop in the middle of 15. Then she let them down by a rope through the window. As noted, for her house was on the city wall, which dwelt on the wall. And so what we wind up beginning to make sense of is, in all likelihood, she would have been on an exterior wall. What she really is asking here is just for a covenant promise. And maybe I shouldn't use the word just, because in reality, she's doing a really big ask here. No matter what happens, no matter how much you come in and devastate this land, this city, we ask that our family be spared, my family be spared. And they agree to this. Now, in verse 17 and 18, they then offer stipulations for this upholding of this oath. 17, then the men said to her, we will be blameless of this oath of ours, which you have made us swear, unless when we come into the land, you bind this line of scarlet cord in the window through which you let us down. And unless you bring your father, your mother, your brothers, and all your father's household to your home. You almost get a sense, for whatever reason in my mind's eye, I'm reminded of we've got a phone booth that we figured out is going to be safe. Get everyone into the phone booth. Let's see if we can get everyone in there. But realistically, they agree to these two terms. We might ask ourselves a series of questions there, even against the backdrop of Passover and unleavened bread. Did Rahab understand the purpose of a scarlet cord? We don't know that. We might have indication to think she might, in that she had faith in God, but we don't necessarily get an answer. Did she know that it was likely a reminder of the blood on the doorposts in Egypt? Well, that's a good possibility. She would have probably remembered that, also knowing what had taken place with the Red Sea. Did she know that that red cord was symbolic of Christ's sacrifice years later? Wow, that's, a big ask. We don't know that. But what we do know is that she followed the instructions she was given. She believed God, and she believed without wavering that God would save her and her family. Which then takes us to verse 21, if you're continuing with me here. Then she said, according to your words, so be it. And she sent them away, and they departed. And she bound the scarlet cord in the window, that marker of, in this case, protection. And so what we find here in verse 21 as we move through the first chapter, Joshua 2, again, we're reminded of Rahab's faith. Let's move then into Joshua 3 and 4. We can put both units together here. Joshua 3, I'll start in verse 1, but I'll jump to verse 5. Then Joshua rose early in the morning and sent out from the acacia grove and came to the Jordan, and he and all the children of Israel and lodged there before they crossed over. So they recognized that they had to, on your little map, they had to go from right to left. They knew the promised land was ahead of them. And again, if we remind ourselves, Joshua had been in this land 40 years before, a younger man, but he would have remembered what was there well. He was given instructions then. If we drop down in terms of them crossing over into the promised land, verse 5, and Joshua said to the people, sanctify yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you. He will do this incredible miracle for you. Verse 6, then Joshua spoke to the priests, saying, take up the Ark of the Covenant and cross over before the people. So they took up the Ark of the Covenant and went before the people. And again, this is a beautiful read, even as you make sense of what's here. If we pause long enough to make sense of what's in verses 5 and 6, the term sanctify means to cleanse. In other words, don't show up with an ugly, you know, burger-stained T-shirt on. Get yourself mentally, physically, if not spiritually, ready to cross. The term itself, in terms of sanctify, means cleanse, purify, prepare yourself properly for the promised land. And maybe in the back of my head, I'm oftentimes reminded that, for example, if I ever go to someone's house to eat, I don't generally just show up in some kind of sweaty overalls to walk in. I do what I can to make sure that indeed I'm nicely dressed, presentable, I guess is the word we use today, and I'm respectful when I go in. And that's kind of what you gather from what's here. God says to Joshua here that he will set Joshua apart, and the upcoming verses then indicate this. He starts to separate Joshua for Israel as someone that they can rely on, and someone, more importantly, that looks to God. So even as they follow those instructions, they're following God's instructions. And so we see all this play out. Joshua then directs the people to God for instruction. Drop to verse 13. Here's where they wind up crossing. Verse 13, the Jordan River. And it shall come to pass as soon as the soles of the feet of the priests who bear the ark of the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of the Jordan, that the waters of the Jordan shall be cut off. I'm going to stop. The waters that come down from upstream, that they shall stand as a heap. Now, we would probably, again, be reminded here that that story, that account, the events that took place in the Red Sea had to have kind of come back to them. The idea that they had already crossed through something. Some have said, depending on who you read, they've said, well, the Jordan River is not really that big a deal. But if you read this section, there's something that happens around the spring harvest. Generally, that area is flooded, and it tends to be fast-moving streams. Now, is it something akin to, say, what we saw, July 4th, just a few years ago in Texas, where you go from very, you know, small, maybe 70, you know, several tens of yards to hundreds of yards? We can't say that. But we do know from what's offered here in terms of what's recorded that this was a significant river that they were crossing. This was not just a small stream that they were crossing. So what God tells them to do, those who happen to be the priests, is walk into it and stand. And when you do so, that ground will be just as hard as there's no water in it, which is indeed exactly what winds up happening. And so what we find here is even as the Red Sea 40 years earlier was something they crossed, picturing baptism, that symbolism had to resonate with them. It had to come back to them. If we drop down here then to verse 16, and the waters which came down from upstream stood still and rose up in a heap very far away at Adam, the city, is behind Zertan. So the waters that went down into the Sea of Arabah, the salt sea, failed and were cut off, and the people crossed over opposite Jericho. Then the priests who bore the Ark of the Covenant stood firm on dry ground in the midst of Jordan, And all Israel crossed over on dry ground until all the people had crossed completely over the Jordan. How many people are we talking here? Is this like a small group? Is it about, what, 150 of us crossing? If you do the math and get some sense of how many people crossed here, two things at least for me come to mind. One is obviously this is a miracle. Maybe an additional thought here is that the priests that were holding that ark up had to be strong guys. Because in this case, if we had at that time, by mathematical standards, roughly about 600,000, if it helps, in the army, this would be 2 to 3 million people that would cross through. So we're not talking like 5 minutes run across. We're talking about a long period of time for them to stand there. A staggering amount of time for them to stand there, all on dry ground. As we wind up figuring out here, as we make sense of what's offered, Israel crosses on dry ground. If we jump to chapter 4, God instructs them then to establish a memorial. If you're with me in verse 5, we'll keep reading. And Joshua said to them, cross over before the ark of the Lord your God into the midst of the Jordan, and each of you take up a stone. So even as they cross in, I'm going to guess that in all likelihood, someone of decent size would have said, I'm picking up this stone and I'm carrying it over because this represents our tribe. Put up a stone on his shoulder. It doesn't act like he put it in his pocket, according to the number of the tribes of the children of Israel. That this may be a sign among you when your children ask in time to come, saying, what do these stones mean? And then he offers a reminder, even as we drop down here, making sense of this memorial. It's important at least to note, even as we wander through here, that this was a significant memorial that they were establishing. It was a reminder for all of Israel exactly who God was and what he'd done for them at this time. I'll only make reference to what takes place in verse 19 because it's a reminder, even as we kept the Passover, that a lamb was chosen on the 10th day of the first month. It notes this here. It's helpful to recognize that. And if we drop down all the way to verse 22, I'll back up to 21. Then he spoke to the children of Israel, saying, when your children ask their fathers in time to come, saying, what are these stones? Then you shall let your children know, saying, Israel crossed over the Jordan on dry land, for the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan before you until you had crossed over, as the Lord your God did to the Red Sea, reminder there, which he dried up before us until we had crossed over, that all the peoples of the earth know the hand of the Lord, that it is mighty, and that you may fear the Lord your God forever. So we've moved through the Jordan River, and we've made our way up here to chapter 5. What we wind up finding then in chapter 5 is, maybe I feel curious, I wouldn't think of circumcision when we moved into the Promised Land, but that's indeed what happens. In addition to acknowledging the spring feast, we see them actually enter the Promised Land. And if you're with me then, making sense of what's here, in verses 6 through 9, we see a circumcision. And we might ask, why in the world are they having a circumcision ceremony when they move in? Well, by explanation, and Joshua makes sense of this, they had not been circumcising their younger men prior to this time. So in this case, it was a reflective of a covenant relationship with God. And we see that then in verses 6 through 9. If you're with me up to verse 10, this is what we addressed with Mr. Graby a week ago. If we're moving forward to verse 10, it reads this way, for the children of Israel camped in Gilgal and kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month at twilight on the plains of Jericho. So they were close enough in keeping it. You can probably imagine that if you were in Jericho, you could look out and you in all likelihood would see all of these camps in the distance, all of these people out there. Probably thought to yourself, well, they're not coming in here. We've got walls. But they could have seen these individuals by that time. They would have been well aware of what was taking place. Even as, in this case, Israel would have been keeping it as a memorial to God. Verse 11, and they ate the produce of the land on the day after the Passover, unleavened bread and parched grain on the very same day. And so what we find here again is Israel eats of the land. And what we find then here shortly, if we continue, is that the manna, remember the manna, the only primary food source for the last 40 years, God cuts it off. You're now in the promised land. I'm now giving you the produce of the land. Verse 13, and it came to pass when Joshua was by Jericho that he lifted his eyes and he looked. Now, again, it's a reminder that Joshua had been here 40 years before. I have no idea from time to time if you've ever found yourself at a spot, maybe in for those of us who happen to be older, and you say, remember when we were here last time, what took place? I think about from time to time, Sarah and I will take our son and daughter somewhere and we'll say, yeah, here is where, and these stories will come flooding back. At times, stories that I don't recount or haven't recounted for years, but working through or walking through and talking through exactly what took place there, you could almost get a sense that Joshua did about the same. Knowing where he was, knowing that they were on the plains of Jericho, knowing that he had been through this land prior for 40 years before this, he was well aware of what was there. There also had to be some anticipation, even as he understood that they were to take this city. And so as he stands there and looks at Jericho, the following happens. He lifts his eye and looked, and behold, a man stood opposite him with his sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said, are you for us or are you against us? Are you our adversary? So he said, no, but as commander of the army of the Lord, I have now come. And Joshua fell on his face on the earth and worshiped and said to him, what does my Lord say to his servants? Then the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, and if this feels familiar, if it helps, this language is the same language that was given to Moses some time back. Take your sandal off your foot, for the place you stand is holy. Joshua stood in the presence of the pre-incarnate Jesus Christ, the God of the Old Testament. And so what we find here is this amazing meeting. And what we also gather here is we don't get a sense here that the Jesus Christ that we oftentimes see depicted maybe in our art from, you know, more recent and some time ago, that this was not any wimpy commander. This is someone who is certainly probably incredibly intimidating to look at. And so even as we see what's there, he's given the charge by, in this case, the God of the Old Testament, Christ, that you're going to go in and take this. Which then takes us to the climax of the story. Even as we've made sense of what's here, we've made our way up to Joshua 6, and here's where the story really starts to unfold. We'll read a little bit more here. Verse 1 reads this way, now Jericho was securely shut up because of the children of Israel. None went out and none came in. And the Lord said to Joshua, see, I have given Jericho into your hand, its king and the mighty men of valor. You know, even as they had opportunity to see that this was now their city for the taking, he probably had to think through, what is this involved? And God's going to explain this to him. And you shall march around the city, all your men of war, and you shall go all around the city once. This you shall do for 6 days. So how big was this city? By many standards, it would take about 3/8 of a mile where they have established the outer wall of the city. In this case, even if we have 3/8 of a mile, and some will offer that in likelihood they wouldn't have necessarily have marched immediately next to the wall. They might have marched a little bit further out. How far would that distance be? Well, if you're getting some sense of math, it looks as though this would be possibly about a 3/4 mile circumference. So if we're making sense of what they're going to do in terms of marching, that gives us some idea of the length that they will march each day. And the Lord said to Joshua, See, I've given you Jericho into your hand, its king and the mighty man. I read that. You shall march around the city, all your men, and do so for 6 days. And then he gives them a specific order. The seven priests shall bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. But the seventh day you shall march around the city 7 times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. And it shall come to pass when they make a long blast with a ram's horn, and when you hear the sound of the trumpet, that all the people shall shout with a great shout. And the wall of the city will fall down flat, and the people shall go up, every man straight before him. So he gives these instructions right off the bat. And so he goes and tells the people of all of this. And indeed, they wind up in the exact same order that God instructs. They wind up, if it helps, with military in front of the priests. Now, how big was this military? Well, we've already speculated. The military could have been as many as 600,000. Do we know 600,000 men led the ark? We don't know that. We do know this, and I have to tell you, this was maybe a misnomer, if nothing else, an error in my database. I routinely have thought that all of Israel circled the city, and it's not what it says. The instructions were given for those who happen to be the military and the priests to circle. What then, and there's then speculation about this, what then, where were the people at the time? Well, we've seen in other accounts, and we've seen in similar Bible stories, that it wasn't uncommon for a city to kind of wrap itself around, or a nation to wrap itself around a city. Do we get indication of that? We don't know that. But we just know that there's instructions principally for those who happen to be the military and the priests to walk. And so that much we see. If we drop down to verse 10, they're given instructions, even as they're told to walk, to not make a sound. Verse 10, now Joshua had commanded the people, saying, "You shall not shout or make any noise, nor any word proceed out of your mouth until the day I say to you, shout. Then you shall shout." And so even as we make sense of this in terms of some sense of chronology, for 6 days straight, beginning on the first day of unleavened bread, there would have been, you can probably imagine, military comes out, the ark follows, there would be this processional that took place. However, wherever they were in terms of hiding, and we get a sense that in likelihood, they probably were in tents and or in trees, if not palms of every sort, which happened to be in the region, there would have been this processional that came out that then circled the city. And you can probably sense that on day one, that everyone in the city thought to themselves, what a joke. How ludicrous. Why are these guys walking around the city? We don't even get a sense, which is interesting, even in this storyline, we have no sense of military weapons. Now, we happen to know that those who happen to be leading the ark were considered military, but we don't get any sense of you know, some formidable armed forces. We don't get a sense for what's there. We just know that they come out, they walk around the city, and then they return. And we wait for day two, and day three, and day four, up to day seven, which is really curious that every day that we see this. And again, if you're in the city, at some point you would think to yourself, maybe day one or day two, I would think, oh, this is hilarious. Honey, get me another beer. They're back out. Let's watch. Let's see what they do today. Maybe they'll have jugglers today. All they did was walk. Day seven comes. You could probably get a sense there's a little bit of tension going now. So they're going to walk once. Wait a second. They're lapping it. They're going again. And this time, it looks like they're walking with more purpose. What's going on here? No one's saying anything. And three, and four, and five, and six. And if you drop with me to verse 16, we make our way up to the seventh lap. And the seventh time it was so that the priests blew the trumpets, that Joshua said to the people, again, by many explanations, it would be the people were some distance. But after being quiet for that long a period of time, I would guess that they've stored up some pretty nice volume. And they said, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the city. Now the city shall be doomed by the Lord to destruction, it and all who are in it. Only Rahab the harlot shall live, she and all who are with her in her house, because she hid the messengers that we sent. And by all means, keep yourselves from the accursed things." Now, we happen to know, and Mr. Graby actually touches on this, there was a hitch in our giddy-up, if we look by language. Regrettably, as we get to 7, there's going to be someone who doesn't follow instructions. But by and large, everyone else is going to follow instructions. "By this, all means shall keep yourselves from the accursed things, lest you become accursed when you take of the accursed things and make the camp of Israel a curse and trouble it." And so as we make our way down, there is then that shout. So the people in verse 20, when the priest blew the trumpets, and it happened when the people heard the sound of the trumpet, and the people shouted with a great shout that the wall fell down flat. This is an oddity. Archaeologists all are in agreement on this. Generally, when you deal with walls, they either collapse down or in. They don't fall forward. There is no reason for them to fall forward except by the hand of God. Every archaeologist that have gone to Jericho and documenting what's there have said, here's the oddity of it all. The walls fell out. They fell out almost like ramps, which it would have been unconventional had they just collapsed or fallen in, because they would have been struggling over rubble in order to get into the city and follow God's commands. But that's not what happens. You almost wind up with this beautiful sidewalk right into the city, which is remarkable, because the people are going in now. And so we see that in verse 20, then the people went up into the city, every man straight before him, and they took the city, and even as God instructed them, and they utterly destroyed all that was in the city, both man and woman, young and old, ox and sheep and donkey, with the edge of the sword. On the last day of unleavened bread, even as a reminder for putting sin out, God instructed them, wipe everything out, only keep what's precious for me. And so even as they followed those instructions, God guided them. Verse 22, but Joshua had said to the two men who had spied out of the city, go find that harlot. Go find Rahab. We save her. Go into the harlot's house, and from there bring out the woman and all that she has, as you swore to her. And the young men who had been spies went in and brought out Rahab, her father, her mother, her brothers, and all she had, that she brought out all her relatives and left them outside the camp of Israel, all of her lineage. This person that you would likely say, it makes no sense. Her lifestyle doesn't deserve that. But God saw in her that faith that she needed. And if we keep reading then from there, verse 24, but they burned the city and all that was in it. Only the silver and gold and the vessels of bronze and iron that they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord. God was very specific about, keep these things, get rid of everything else. And Joshua spared Rahab the harlot, her father's household and all that she had. So she dwells in Israel to this day because she had hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho. Then Joshua charged them at that time, saying, cursed be the man before the Lord who rises up and rebuilds Jericho. Don't go back here. He shall lay its foundation with his firstborn. In other words, your offspring will be killed. It will become foundation. And with his youngest, he shall set up its gates. So the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame spread throughout the country. All happened on the last day of unleavened bread. What do we then find in terms of Israel's victory here that we can take away in terms of this last day of unleavened bread? Well, let me leave you with three lessons and we'll be done. First, by way of Rahab, we learn that victory comes when faith is first in our lives. Victory comes when faith is first in our lives. Let's hit a couple of verses. We'll go back to Joshua 2, if you will, Joshua 2, and we will reread verse 11, even as we read it a little bit earlier. And as soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted. This is Rahab's account. Neither did there remain any more courage in anyone because of you, for the Lord your God, unmistakably, unequivocally, can't say that word, he is God. Your God is our God, is my God. It's one and the same. He is God in heaven above and on earth. And so what we're reminded here is indeed this individual who most of us would just discount if we walk by her. Or we would say, yeah, that's the harlot that's over on, you know, on the wall of the city. Just leave her alone. God saw her faith. God lists her as faithful in Hebrews 11. When we go there, Hebrews 11, go with me there. Hebrews 11, verses 30 and 31. Does God find faith of value? Does God find our belief in him of value? She was unwavering in what she understood. By faith, the walls of Jericho. Hebrews 11, verse 30. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they were encircled for 7 days. And who gets the free feature role here? By faith, the harlot Rahab did not perish with those who did not believe when she had received the spies with peace. And so what we find here remarkably is that she receives these spies, and knowing who they represent, she says, let me be a part of your God. Let me be connected with your God. Save me and my family. And indeed, that's what God offers. James 2, verse 25 offers just reinforcement for how God viewed her. James 2 and verse 25, it reads simply this way, if we're dropping down, this is about the fact of faith with works. On this section, it reads this way in verse 25, James 2. Likewise, was not Rahab the harlot also justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out another way? I don't know about you, but from time to time, I can read this account and I think to myself, well, didn't she just deceive them? How can she be rewarded for this? And then I find myself back at Acts 5, verse 29, if you remember what's offered there. It's better to obey God than man. When we're in those difficult situations where the choice is, do I obey God or do I obey man? God always wins. So she winds up protecting them. And in this case, she winds up not just protecting them and living on, she winds up in the lineage of Christ. How remarkable a story. I'll let you go on your own. Matthew 1, verse 5, under Joseph's lineage, Rahab, if you recall, happened to have been the mother of Boaz. We remember Ruth and Boaz, which would make, in this case, the great-great-grandmother of David, and the line of Jesus Christ. So her faith made her a hero. And so what we find here is this wonderful story of Rahab. We learn that faith comes first. Victory takes place when faith comes first. Secondly, we learn by way of Joshua that victory comes when trust follows faith. Victory comes when trust follows faith. So it's sometimes difficult to deal with the nuances between trust and faith. And if you go look at the definitions, they are closely related. No complaints there. Routinely, though, faith deals with belief. Trust deals with reliance on God, in this case, over time. What we find from Joshua's story is that Joshua indeed trusted God. Put another way, Joshua relied on God. He didn't just acknowledge God. He didn't just know him. He lived his life reflective of a relationship with God. He relied on God the first time he went into the land to spy it out. He relied on God when he took the helm of leadership from Moses. He relied on God whenever he was told to take the city. And so what we find all the way through is Joshua gives us this sterling example of someone who trusts God. If you will, Joshua 1, verses 5 through 8. We skipped over this without aiming to neglect what's here, but only as a reminder of how God viewed, in this case, Joshua, and how Joshua viewed God. If you're with me, the words here are going to be pretty familiar, even as we make sense of what's offered. Joshua 1, verses 5 through 8, this section that then preceded our storyline for Jericho. Verse 5 reads this way, "No man shall be able to stand before you," this being the instruction given to Joshua, "all the days of your life, as I was with Moses, so I will be with you, and I will not leave you nor forsake you." And then he's given this admonition that we oftentimes recite and recount on our own. "Be strong and of good courage, for to this land you shall divide as an inheritance the land which I swore to their fathers to give them." One of the individuals who was writing on this, and depending on who you read, they'll oftentimes offer accounts. They'll say that even as Israel entered the land, Jericho would have represented the first fruits, a sacrifice to God in that land. Verse 7 reads, "Only be strong and very courageous, that you may observe to do according to all the law which Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may prosper wherever you go." And we can end the thought in verse 8. And here is a reflection and a connection with the first message that we had. "This book of the law," this is what Mr. Beam just read, "shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate it day and night." That's how we're transformed. Even as we submit ourselves to God, as we spend time in prayer and meditation and fasting and study, and God's Spirit changes us, and it will change us, even as we see here, we're told to observe all these things, that you may observe to do according to all that is written in it. "For then you will make your way prosperous." There's this beautiful tag on the back end. If you do these things, it will result in failure. That's not what it says. You will be ostracized and left out of every enjoyable thing in your life. That's not what it says. It says if you follow this book, you will prosper and have success. Anyone who has no sense of who God is wants to be prosperous and successful. And here we get a clear sense of exactly what God tells Joshua what he'll be. Be strong and of good courage. And so what we find here is that Joshua's story is a story of reliance on God. He does so beautifully through his leadership of Israel. Let's go to a third point. By way of Israel, we learn victory comes when Israel obeys God. So even as we had a chance to see what was here offered in the story, after 40 years of wandering aimlessly, it certainly was an opportunity to take a break from the past. I want to ask you to just go to Joshua 5, and I skipped over this without aiming to limit what was here, and you may recall what the language is in Joshua 5, verse 9, but it's telling what's here because commentaries will oftentimes go deep in terms of exploring what this actually means. Joshua 5, verse 9 offers this. Even as the Israelites had been wandering for 40 years, verse 9 reads this way, "Then the Lord God said to Moses, 'This day I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you.'" Are we back to our first message again here? What he's saying is all of the burden that you've had in leaving Egypt, it's time to unload it. It's no longer there. Walk away from that. And it's really powerful language. Therefore, the name of the place is called Gilgal to this day. And so what we find here is that when the people obeyed, and they obeyed beautifully, at least in this account with the exception of Achan, when the people obeyed and they followed God, the males were circumcised. They kept the Passover, and they kept unleavened bread. and even as told specific instructions around Jericho and outside of Jericho in terms of responsibility, when told to shout, shout, the people shouted in unity and went up into the city and took what they were told to take and burned everything else. Archaeology shows, all the science behind this shows exactly these events taking place there. There's no question of this. What we then find from this story of Jericho is we find faith, the importance of faith in God. We find that from, in this case, Rahab, trust or reliance on God, even as we saw from Joshua, and obedience, right action. That when we do these things, when we are not only faithful but trusting and then obedient, then God promises to give us victory, success, as we see in language. We succeed when we follow all three steps. It really is a moving story, and it's one that poignantly is fitting for us to cover on this last day of unleavened bread as we anticipate leaving these days and looking forward to the next feast. In 1990, Dr. Bryant Wood in Biblical Archaeology Today wrote this in an article entitled, "Did the Israelites Conquer Jericho? A New Look at Archaeological Evidence." Although the ancient mound of Jericho still bears the marks of its past, he offers the following: its story remains. It holds centuries-old archaeological and biblical reminders of the great power of God, the Lord God, Israel's God, our God, even as Rahab stated, is the God of heaven and earth. That God promises to help us overcome any obstacle, no matter what we face, even as we look toward God's kingdom. While we leave the days of unleavened bread that end tonight at sunset, let us not leave the lessons that we find through these days, and particularly in this story about Jericho with Rahab and Joshua and Israel's miraculous victory. Let this story and those lessons then compel us to move forward, to rely on God even more as we face the next challenges in our lives.